at time, and hopefully you're in the right place. My name is Trevor Thompson, and this is Eyes Wide Open, singing the songs anew. Brief introduction of myself. I am an acquisitions editor for Erdman's Publishing Company, as well as an adjunct professor at Calvin College, where I teach undergraduates and have a lot of fun doing that. As I was reminded this January when going through a bit of adjunct orientation, it's always good to provide trigger warnings whenever you're going to be talking about delicate content. And I think many of you know what to expect if you've chosen to attend a class on the Song of Songs. But we're also going to be looking at some of the more scandalous passages in the Bible. So I offer a trigger warning as we begin to those for whom that might be appropriate. So I was recently in the store. I was there to purchase some envelopes, and the layout of this particular store has the books and the magazines section right next to the office supply section. And I couldn't see what was going on in the aisle behind me, but there was a woman who I assume is a mother, and there was a child talking, and I heard the child's voice first, and the child said, "Look, Mommy, they have lots of wrestling books like you do." And I thought, that's kind of very strange. And I just kind of went on about my business trying to select the appropriate manila folder. And then all of a sudden, I heard the child reading. Just a few little words got out. It was, "The Viking Ragnon grabbed the woman." And all of a sudden, the woman just starts yelling, "Stop! Stop! Stop!" And I realized a number of things at that moment. That Mommy's wrestling books, which I'm guessing have lots of bare-chested men on the cover, etc., are actually romance novels, and that she had just boglarized her son in that moment from presenting the entire world with a reading from this romance novel that the young man happened upon. It was more interesting because I kept looking, you know, pulling out the envelopes that I needed, and they walked past the aisle, and she was clearly completely flushed. She was just bright red, and she seemed to be short of breath, and she'd actually had a physiological response to this experience of her child beginning to announce, with all of his reading skills, the reading of a romance novel there in the middle of the afternoon in the store. I think Thomas Bodler would have been happy with her for cutting off the sun and editing the content for the ears of all within earshot of this young, earnest child. I also think he probably would have had something to say to the store owners about their choice of novels there on display. And I've begun a handout. I hope everybody has a handout with Thomas Bodler. And just a brief note about him, and I've included there an advertisement from the 1819 edition of The Family Shakespeare. And I just want to read that really quickly. "The Family Shakespeare, in which nothing is added to the original text, but those words and expressions are omitted, which cannot with propriety be read aloud in a family. By the author, my great objects in this undertaking are to remove from the writings of Shakespeare some defects which diminish their value, and at the same time to present to the public an edition of his plays, which the parent, the guardian, and the instructor of youth may place without fear in the hands of the pupil, and from which the pupil may derive instruction as well as pleasure, may improve his moral principles while he refines his taste, and without incurring the danger of being hurt with an indelicacy of expression, may learn in the face of Macbeth that even a kingdom is dearly purchased if virtue be the price of acquisition." I don't know if any of you have ever read or heard of Thomas Bodler or read The Family Shakespeare. It's a fun exercise because you really do not get the full Shakespeare when you have that experience. Thomas Bodler did not have his method or way with the Song of Songs, and so I want to now transition and read the excerpt at the bottom of the first page of your handout. Song of Songs 4:1-10. "Look at you, so beautiful, my dearest. Look at you, so beautiful. Your eyes are doves behind the veil of your hair. Your hair is like a flock of goats as they stream down Mount Gilead. Your teeth are like newly shorn ewes as they come up from the washing pool, all of them perfectly matched, not one of them lacks its twin. Like a crimson ribbon are your lips. When you smile, it is lovely. Like a slice of pomegranate is the curve of your face behind the veil of your hair. Like David's tower is your neck, splendidly built. 1,000 shields are hung upon it, all the weapons of the warriors. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle doe, that graze among the lilies. Before the day breeze blows and the shadows flee, I will be off to the mountain of myrrh, to the hill of frankincense. You are utterly beautiful, my dearest. There's not a single flaw in you. The Bible, as many of you know, is one of the most widely distributed, widely read texts in the world, certainly in the Western world. And texts do different things, and they touch people in different ways. And there are beautiful, soaring portions of the Bible that meet the greatest standards of rhetoric. There are portions of the Bible that speak timeless truths that can literally be taken out of their biblical context and applied in any number of different contexts, philosophy or other religions, and they are applicable. But there are other texts in the Bible that are a bit more difficult, just a bit. And they require a little more care. They require a little more attention. And it's not something new to recognize that. It's a long-standing recognition. And I've assembled here a set of texts that I call scandalous scripture. And so you don't have to listen to me read all of these texts. I need some intrepid volunteers. Some of you have quickly scanned this list, and you're already eyeing certain texts that you're not going to be responsible for reading. So if you have your favorite, you know, you can kind of get ready for that. But I just need a quick show of hands so we can kind of move through this quickly. Can I get someone to read Genesis 19:8? There, and then how about Genesis 38:8 through 10? How about Judges 19, okay, 25 through 28? 1 Samuel 15... Okay, 3. 1 Samuel 18, 25 through 27. 2 Kings 2, 23 through 20. We're there. And then Psalm 137, 9. And then back in the back, Proverbs 5, 18 to 20. And then one more, Ezekiel 23, 19 through 20. Got it. All right, so just read it real quickly. These are all from the Common English Bible, which I've indicated by the CEB. Read, and then... I'll make a couple of comments, and then we'll read the next one and kind of go through before we get to the main focus of what we're going to be doing for most of our time. So here we go.
I've got two daughters who are virgins. Let me bring them out to you, and you may do to them whatever you wish. But don't do anything to these men, because they are now under the protection of my roof.
It's always fun to actually read this story in its entirety in a college setting with undergraduates. Because many, particularly many who come from Christian homes or Christian high schools, they have a very clear sense of what the Sodom and Gomorrah story is or what they think the Sodom and Gomorrah story is. And then you ask them about this verse and they're horrified about the context and what is actually being offered in that moment. And it usually is a good moment of kind of discussion and reflection about the real meaning of that text. Okay, the next one, Genesis 38, 8 through 10.
Judah said to Onan, "Go to your brother's wife, do your duty to her, brother-in-law, and provide children for your brother." Onan knew the children wouldn't be his, so when he slept with his brother's wife, he wasted his semen on the ground, so he wouldn't give his brother children. The Lord considered what he did as wrong and put him to death too.
Well, there's a lot going on there. Let me hear from you a couple of things that are sort of, Do what?
I said that are sort of what?
Just whatever. I mean, just things that make you go, or things that are like, okay, maybe not that one for the nighttime story, or...
Well, definitely in our culture, you know, the idea that, like, well, you know, your sister-in-law needs children. You're going to give her children. That's a very foreign concept to us.
Okay, so it's a little bit outside of the norm of contemporary Christian purity cult kind of stuff, yeah?
Once you accept the cultural background, the audacity that he would refuse to do this.
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
And then that the Lord considered him wrong and put him to death.
Yeah, that's a bit of a strong measure. Mm-hmm. in that particular case. All right, let's do the next one. Judges 19, 25 through 28.
But the men refused to listen to him. So the Levite grabbed his secondary wife and sent her outside to them. They raped her and abused her all night long until morning. They finally let her go as dawn was breaking. At daybreak, the woman came and collapsed at the door of the man's house where her husband was staying, where she lay until it was daylight. When her husband got up in the morning, he opened the doors of the house and went outside to set out on his journey. And there was his secondary wife, lying at the entrance of the house, with her hands clutching the door frame. "Get up," he said to her. "Let's go." But there was no response. So he laid her across the donkey, and the man set out for home.
I did the reading through the Bible thing throughout my youth. And somehow this passage, I don't know if someone had selectively removed it from the Bible that I have. I just don't remember actually reading it or maybe understanding what I was reading until I was in high school. And I stumbled across it. I was that kid who liked to, you know, that Sunday night that some of you may have had growing up as kids where you could ask questions of the preacher and you put them in a little box. And I remember once, and I don't take any pride in this, but I asked for an explanation of this verse. And it's one of those things where the preacher's literally pulling them out and has not seen them, so like he's the answer man, and that was an awkward moment for everybody involved. 1 Samuel 15 and verse 3.
So go, attack the Amalekites. Put everything that belongs to them under the ban. Spare no one. Kill men and women, children and infants, oxen and sheep, camels and donkeys.
Thoughts on that one?
We have a hard time with genocide.
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, again, as you talk to people and you take polls of where they are on various moral issues, you'd be pretty hard-pressed to find people who are encouraging genocide. At least I've never had.
The innocents were there. The infants and the sheep and camels and donkeys. I mean, what
It is the so-called ban. And it's sort of strange, and I don't know if the violence that exists, that really permeates at least the one portion of the biblical text, if I just became immune to it. Again, one of my epiphany moments was when I realized that what we had reenacted in VBS with the walls of Jericho was actually genocide. And I thought, oh, that was a lot of fun, and all the blocks fell down, and I enjoyed painting them all, but what did we actually just reenact in that moment? And the older I've gotten, now I have a son, and it is passages like that where the innocents are involved and children are involved that actually give me more problem, I mean, in terms of just the outrage and the horror, than some of the more scandalous bits that would have intrigued me more as a young man or a teenager. 1 Samuel 18, 25 through 27.
And Saul replied, "Tell David this, the king doesn't want any bridal gift, just 100 Philistine foreskins as vengeance on the king's enemies." Saul was hoping that David would die at the hands of the Philistines. When the servants reported this to David, he was happy to become the king's son-in-law. Even before the allotted time had expired, David got up and went with his soldiers and killed 100 Philistines. David brought their foreskins and counted them out for the king so he could become the king's son-in-law. Then Saul gave his daughter Michal to him in marriage.
Thoughts on that passage?
One, two, three, four.
Mel Gibson making this into a movie now.
Yes.
Showing that scene.
What would that be rated?
R.
No, you're absolutely right. I actually haven't looked. I don't know if any of you are familiar, but there's a wonderful website called The Brick Testament, mm-hmm. which has the entire Bible in Legos,
yeah.
And it's a bit satirical. I often use it as a way of teaching the book of Revelation because you cannot depict in a way that you can show in a college classroom some of the things that are going on in the book of Revelation. But I need to look up and see what particular rendering they have there. 2 Kings 2, 23-24.
Elisha went up from there to Bethel. As he was going up on the road, some young people came out of the city, and they mocked him. "Get going, Baldy, get going, Baldy." Turning around, Elisha looked at them and cursed them in the Lord's name. Then two bears came out of the woods and mangled 42 of the youths.
They weren't taught to honor.
They weren't. I remember actually reading that, thinking, I lived on the south side of Chicago for a number of years, and the memory of Emmett Till is a strong thing. There are streets named after Emmett Till, and that story continues to evolve as now some of the actors get really old, and there recently has been in the news. But you know, we look at the horror of that, and so at least the story that was told is that this young northern African American young man supposedly insulted a white woman in the South when that wasn't supposed to happen, and suffered the consequences of that, which was the loss of his life in that particular cultural setting, and there are difficulties with justice, etc. And now it turns out actually he didn't even say anything to her, by her own admission, now that she's an older woman. But this story is kind of odd that as a result of calling somebody Baldy, there's the mauling of bears. All right. Psalm 137:9. This is tough.
A blessing on the one who seizes your children and smashes them against the rock.
That's tough. All right. Proverbs 5:18-20.
May your spring be blessed, rejoice in the wife of your youth. She is a lovely deer, a graceful doe. Let her breasts intoxicate you all the time. Always be drunk on her love. Why, my son, should you lose your senses with a mysterious woman and embrace the breasts of a foreign female?
All right, part of that beginning part of the book of Proverbs with so many exhortations about wisdom with this direction often towards young men. And then finally, Ezekiel 23:19-20.
That's a lot. But she added to her promiscuities, bringing to mind her youthful days when she was a prostitute in the land of Egypt. She lusted after the male consorts whose sexual organs were like those of donkeys and whose ejaculation was like that of horses. She relived the wicked days of her youth when the Egyptians touched and fondled her young and nubile breasts.
Yeah, I really missed that one growing up somehow and stumbled across that somewhere in the course of graduate school and thought to myself, huh. The Bible, if you were to rate it, and this, many of you are aware of this, you know, certain texts are definitely R, if not even pushing boundaries in terms of what can be actually shown on a big screen. But biblical literature and literature in general, this is not unique. It's not like the Bible is the only book that explores these themes. And it is not as though a book like the Song of Songs, which is this dialogue between a man and a woman switching back and forth as one talks about the other and the other talks back and forth, praising the beauty and extolling love and dwelling in that. This is not unique in literature, right? In many different places and times, people have thought about love, they've thought about the human body, and they've commemorated that in writing. There's an interesting text called The Perfumed Garden of Sensual Delight, which if you read any sort of academic literature about the Song of Songs, they will often tell you that there are lots of parallels in the ancient Near Eastern world, the world out of which the Song of Songs emerged. But then they'll also have usually a page or two in any decent commentary of rattling off later examples that are not exactly like the Song of Songs in terms of being poetry, but there are remarkable similarities. This particular work is interesting because it emerges in an Arabic context. Right, and it is written by one Abu Abdullah Muhammad ibn Muhammad al-Nafsawi between 1410, 1411 to 1434. And this is just a note from the translator. The book deals with sex in an open and uninhibited way. It is by turns serious and amusing, almost sublime and quite ridiculous. Sin and shame are specifically excluded from this garden, where sexual pleasure is a divine gift we all have the right to enjoy. And just to give you a sense of the chapter titles of this particular book, they're listed here for you. You have The Man of Quality, the woman of quality, the repulsive man, the repulsive woman, sexual intercourse, sexual technique, the harmful effects of intercourse, names for the penis, names for the vulva, the members of animals, women's tricks, questions and answers for men and women, the causes and stimulation of sexual desire, remarks on female sterility and methods of treatment, the causes of male sterility, ways to provoke miscarriage, treatment for three types of erection problems, how to expand and enlarge the smaller penis, how to remove underarm and vaginal odor and tighten the vagina, the symptoms of pregnancy, and how to determine the sex of the unborn child, and finally, the benefits of eggs and sexually stimulating beverages. Now, again, this is a 15th century text written in Arabic. It should not surprise you that the copies that remain of it are in terrible condition, and it's quite a scholarly feat to assemble them and do any sort of what was the original text here and try to translate them, but we have this translation that was done by a British publisher. I started to include a portion about the man of quality. Unfortunately, the man of quality really focuses on one particular piece of anatomy in kind of great detail, quoting poetry, Arabic poetry, etc. And so I've landed again on the woman of quality, which is a nice balance, I think, actually, with the portion from the Song of Songs we just looked at the very beginning. And this is part of a long description of the woman of quality. There are many different types of women, some of whom are attractive and desirable to men, and some of whom are not. For a man, the woman of quality has a full and voluptuous figure, jet black hair, a broad forehead, arched eyebrows and wide, clear eyes, a moon-shaped face, smooth, soft cheeks, a straight nose and narrow mouth, sweet breath, red lips, and a pink tongue. She has a long neck and full throat, broad shoulders, and chest with large, firm breast and deep cleavage, a neat waist and curved belly with a wide, deep navel, a generous vulva, a soft, tight vagina without discharge or odor, and hot as if almost on fire, broad hips, firm, ample buttocks, tight curves, firm, strong thighs, long, shapely legs, graceful feet, broad arms, and elegant hands. As she walks towards you, she entrances, and when she turns around, she's fatal. And I actually stopped there because I wasn't comfortable continuing with the description that moves on from here. What similarities and differences do you see or hear from what we read of the Song of Songs at the very beginning?
Song of Songs deals more with metaphor, and this is...
just kind of straight there. Right out. Okay, so a little more metaphor in play, maybe?
But it's still a cataloging of the virtues of a woman's body.
It is indeed. This is sort of how it works out. Yeah.
This seems to be, Song of Solomon has more of a real-time visual. Like you notice moves from the eyes to the mouth. It's like he's looking her up to down, which
right.
seems like an experience. This is more of a hypothetical.
Right.
I don't know if it's pretty different.
The two are often brought into comparison in terms of comparative literature, simply because you do have this movement back and forth of describing a man, describing a woman, then a man, kind of back and forth, and they're interesting. The latter text doesn't seem to be dependent in any way, but it does speak to a much broader tradition of where this is common and commonly expressed. But therein lies the rub, because it presents an interpretive challenge, and so we come to Gregory of Nyssa. I'm sure Gregory of Nyssa is on the top of many of your minds as you think about books and authors that you want to read. Gregory is one of the Cappadocian fathers, a brilliant exegete. The question that some of you may want to know pretty quickly is, was Gregory married in light of the way he's going to handle the Song of Songs? And there has been some debate in the history of scholarship as to whether or not Gregory was married, but it's pretty clear from his treatise on virgins that at least he was married. It's not clear if the wife died unexpectedly or if he somehow became unmarried upon assuming the episcopate. Some of the details of his personal life a little bit tricky to actually try to figure out. This is these homilies actually are a response, the homilies on the Song of Songs, and I will say they've not been always very accessible, but just a couple of years ago, the writings from the Greco-Roman World Series, if you really want to get your nerd on, it's a wonderful set of texts. There's Greek on one side and English on the other. We have a new translation that's understandable about his interpretation, so if you're interested in that, you can do that by Frederick Norris. But it seems that Olympias, who was a young, very, very wealthy, connected widow, so she was young in the sense that she was in the 20s, we're not exactly sure what happened to her husband, but she was connected in various ways with imperial offices, that she had apparently sent Gregory a request seeking to have some sort of explanation or understanding of what to do with the Song of Songs. In the midst of this also involves an attempt by the emperor to force her to remarry after the death of her husband, and he actually, for a period of time, sequestered all of her resources in an effort to force her. Families are always being aligned with marriages to do what he wanted her to do, and extended family politics that was that period. This is all in around, we think the request was around 390, 391. Dates are not always really clear. The actual homilies were delivered not as a response in letter form to her, though ultimately it seemed to have reached her, but were actually sermons, hence homilies, delivered to his congregation explaining the text. Gregory was a genius. Some think, others of the Cappadocian fathers were better than him. Some hold him up in high regard. He was deeply, deeply learned in the Greek and Roman rhetorical tradition. He actually began life as a professional rhetorician, kind of a lawyer of sorts. He knew how to talk. He knew how to speak in public. I was actually sitting up looking over the Pacific earlier, and Mark Hamilton, former colleague, came by and looking over my shoulder as I was reading the Greek of Gregory, and he said, "It's not Paul, is it?" And I said, "No, it's not. It's not Paul. It's certainly not John. But it's not Galen, or others. But it can be a bit tricky and a bit heady to get around." But Gregory approaches the text of the Song of Songs with the rhetorical tool belt fully loaded, right? If you have a textual problem, if you have a set of texts that you really don't know what to do with, there are a few people in the world, in his time, who can do what he can do. And he approaches, through a series of sermons, the text of the Song of Songs and applies a method. People call it a variety of things. Some people call it allegorical exegesis. Some people call it anagogical exegesis, typological exegesis. There are a variety of different terms that are applied to it. He actually says at one point in the homilies, "I don't care what you call it, as long as you do it, because you have to move beyond the literal meaning," which is a fascinating rhetorical move. So if you would flip the page over with me, and I have excerpted... And again, there's no way we can go through all of the homilies, which comprise hundreds of pages. But just to get a sense of how Gregory operates and how he is solving the problem of what he considers to be the scandal of the Song of Songs, right? So let's start. I'm now on page 4 of the handout that went around. So there at the top it is: "My hope is that by the right process of inquiry and discernment, once the text has been cleansed of its obvious literal sense by undefiled thoughts, the philosophy hidden in the words may be brought to light." There's a lot going on there. This is his statement of method at the beginning of a sermon. This is how, which you're never supposed to do now, right? This is how I'm going to read this text today. "Once the text has been cleansed of its obvious literal sense," right? Then you can discover the philosophy hidden in the words. What do you think?
It just reminds me of the way that for a long time we've approached, the Song of Songs, as an allegory, you know, and we completely miss what's right there on the surface because that is how we approach it. But he's at least beginning with the honesty to say, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to ignore the immediately obvious and because I've already seen that type of approach.
Well, and one of the reasons why, because even as a child, growing up in a very small church next to a wheat field in western Oklahoma, I learned the word allegory at some point, you know, in my, you know, first through sixth grade education, and I learned it as a way of explaining this text.
Yeah.
I was also strongly encouraged not to use it other places.
Right.
But command example and necessary inference were the preferred models. Yeah. As opposed to, yes, sir.
I was reading the other day about how many of the church fathers viewed sexuality.
Uh-huh.
It was just a very negative view. They saw woman as evil, and to have sex with her is to bring sin into the world. And so when they talked about sexuality, it was not only was it really confined to marriage, but it could only happen on certain times of the year, certain hours of the day. It was really restricted and thought of as, you know, just something to be avoided. And I'm hearing that from him. It's almost like he's saying, in his mind, it can't be about sex that's good.
The church fathers are hard to, like, pin down as a single, you know, they do different things. You know, Origen famously removes his own ability to have sex to great frustration, as he said, because he still remembers the dancing girls even after he performed the surgery on himself, and so the intended outcome didn't happen as he wanted. What's interesting about Gregory is that unlike even immediate members of his family and other of the Cappadocian fathers, he did not join an ascetic community. He did not join the monastic life and seems to have actually been married. But you're right that for him, this text is a dangerous thing, something that has to be grappled with. There's so much I want to say about that. Peter Brown has done a lot of work on the body in the early church fathers. If you want to write that down, look into that. But I'm going to come back to some of those things you talked about at the end. Give me 1 second, though, and then we'll keep going. I'm going to keep reading here. In our earnest search for what is profitable in the inspired scripture, there is nothing to be found that is unsuitable. Therefore, if there is profit, even in the text, just for what it says, we have what is sought right before us. On the other hand, if something is stated in a concealed manner, by way of enigmas and below the surface meanings, and so is void of profit in its plain sense. Now, the question that whenever I read Gregory, I'm going to ask, okay, what is your trigger? What is it that leads you to say, I can't do the literal sense here? And it's fascinating, because I mean, he has the tool belt. He has all the tools to read any text in whatever way he wants. He's trained to do this. What makes him read this text and trigger him to do his thing, for lack of a better way of phrasing it? And so is void of profit in its plain sense, such passages we turn over in our minds, just as the word teaches us in Proverbs, so that we may understand what is said, either as a parable, or as a dark saying, or as a word of the wise, or as an enigma. One may wish to refer to the interpretation of such sayings as tropology or allegory, or by some other name, and this is the thing I was alluding to earlier. We shall not quarrel about the name, as long as a firm grasp is kept on thoughts that edify. And let me just read these last two real quickly, and then I want to have some back and forth conversation. By all these different modes of speech and names for intellectual discernment, the apostle is pointing us to a single form of instruction. And so this doesn't actually follow the quote above it. This is after he's rattled off some examples of Paul using allegory as a way of defending his own move. He says, no, this, look what Paul did in Galatians, right, with Hagar, and et cetera, et cetera. He said, I'm going to do that here, right? The apostle is pointing us to a single form of instruction. One ought not in every instance to remain with the letter, since the obvious sense of the words often does us harm when it comes to the virtuous life. The literal meaning does harm, he says. But one ought to shift to an understanding that concerns the immaterial and intelligible, so that corporeal ideas may be transposed into intellect and thought when the fleshly sense of the words has been shaken off like dust. One more. And now he actually starts marshaling examples. You want some other places where you have to apply this approach? Here we go. This, moreover, is why Paul says the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. For frequently the narrative, if we stop short at the mere events, does not furnish us with models of the good life. How does it profit the cause of a virtuous life to hear that the prophet Hosea got himself a child by sexual malfeasance, and that Isaiah went into the prophetess, if one stops short at the literal sense? Or what do the stories about David, in which adultery and murder have agreed together in a single crime, contribute to the virtuous life? What, at least what seems to be the basic trigger for Gregory here, is twofold, at least in my reading, and this is quick, obviously. But one is, does this text lead to a virtuous life? Now, he doesn't ever actually stop and say, here's a catalog of my exegetical steps, you know, from those graphs, if A, then B, then, you know, and then again. He doesn't do that. He just has a very clear sense about what a virtuous life is. And he looks at text and immediately sort of assesses on its literal meaning, this does not lead to a virtuous life. And there you go. He will also, in other instances, appeal to assorted scriptures that point in the same direction from both Testaments about thinking on things above. And so he has this kind of line, right? And he reads certain texts and he almost makes an instinctual gap. That's things below, right? Which is the warning. That's like the launch codes for do not operate on the literal sense, right? The other way, it tips the other way, and it's like, okay, this is things above, so we can operate with the literal sense. What dangers are there, though, with this? I mean, he's offering this reading for this woman, rich widow, wrestling with questions of marriage herself, trying to understand this text, and what was a complicated time to be a Christian generally, as well as be an aristocratic Roman. What dangers do you see?
Extremely subjective.
It's very subjective, you know. It's brilliant to read, but I often wonder, you know, what grade I would have received if I turned in a paper like that. Because this is not how, in any university I've been affiliated with, we teach students in seminary and other places to read scripture. You know, we read almost as though we're sort of at an historical zoo or amusement park. Like, they read it like that, but we don't do it like that. Yeah.
I think that's just it, though. For most of us that were trained in schools here, we were taught to read in poetry or prose. We were taught to use the language we're using today. Is this literal or is this allegorical? So when we come to Genesis or we come to the Flood or mm-hmm. we come to Song of Solomon or any of this, we don't think in terms of Midrash. We don't think in terms of something can be literal and allegorical. We're taught to choose.
Right.
And I think that that's a danger that we run into, is that we come to this text, whether it's Genesis or whatever, and we say, is this literal?
Right.
Or is this allegorical? Where God is brilliant, and he does both, often at the same time. And I think sometimes we limit ourselves when we say, what am I going to do? What is my approach? What is my systematic, you know, approach to the scripture? When sometimes it's very, very, it can be complex, and it can be both at the same time. You know, and I think that's something that sometimes we have to watch for in some of these scriptures. And that's kind of what Matthew does when he walks you through the Old Testament. It's taking you through literal events. Jesus was, I believe, literally taken down to Egypt, for example, as a child. Mm-hmm. But it was to fulfill scripture, out of Egypt I've called my son. Wow, you're reliving Israel right now, aren't you? You know, mm-hmm. I'm doing both.
Interesting. You know, when you move in the actual text, it's fascinating at times. You know, there's a comparison at one point with Egyptian horses, and he just goes to town with that.
Right.
About, you know, this is now Egypt, and this is coming out of Egypt, an experience of spiritual slavery, and you just lost all of the reference of a beautiful animal and what the comparison is being made there. He does a lot of interesting things with breasts and their location in the body vis-a-vis the heart and warmth, etc. And I was reading, and my wife and I were talking, and I was thinking, does his reading radical rereading of the description, particularly of the female form, in some ways scandalize or do violence toward women. Yeah.
I don't think so. I mean, I'm not a learned person in the Bible by any means. But this seems to me like doing what he has done here is trying to limit God in what he has given to us as beauty and life on earth and the physical side of things that he created, and not, you know, and trying to put everything in a spiritual realm. And although there are many things that can be both, this is one of the things that he gave us for life. This is one of the things that he gave us for beauty.
I think you actually are kind of agreeing in one way with the question I posed, or answering that question.
Yeah, I was saying that.
Yeah.
Whatever his name was, Gregory there.
Yeah.
Limits.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Well, I think when we look at this, you know, obviously any mention of sex, positive or negative, he approaches as it, you know, we're just going to pretend like this mention doesn't even exist. And it, when we take that approach, what we end up doing is we remove discussion of sexuality from the church.
Okay.
We give the voice to somebody else. We make it their problem, and that's how we end up with, you know, a lot of the problems that we have in even discussing it today. You know, that we've kind of approached it from that standpoint. That, well, examples of bad sex in the Bible, you know, things that shouldn't have happened, those are there as an allegorical warning to us. And examples of good sex in the Bible, those are not, you know, warnings to us or instruction on how it should be. This is, you know, also not about sex, you know. Not about the good things we should be doing. And so, I don't know, if we treat every mention of sexuality, positive or negative in Scripture, as something that is either allegorical or a warning against, then we cut the church out of the possibility of discussing what healthy sexuality looks like, or just, you know, how God uses that in our lives as a fulfillment or an enrichment of relationship. So,
you mentioned when you started this talk about R-rated example.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, The Passion of Christ was an R-rated film.
Mm-hmm.
That my youngest son still can't watch because it freaks him out.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I totally embraced it and got a lot out of it because the subject matter, etc. So I mean, I realize there are certain things we shape other kids. You know, my 3-year-old daughter asked where babies come from. It's a very different answer than my 14-year-old who asked the same question.
Right.
So I mean, I realize there's a tearing effect, and maybe that's what Barry is trying to do here, a certain place in time. But it also misses culture. I mean, in Florida, you can come to church and just about anything, and have church on the beach, and it's pretty okay. Whereas in certain other places, you know, if you had shorts on, it would be offensive. The Middle East, if you don't cover your face, it's offensive. The back of the neck is considered a sexual organ. So it's all these elements of culture are not even taken into consideration. So I don't know if I'd want to judge a man by thousands or hundreds of years ago, is that maybe he's trying to speak to a cultural reality, at which time it would be very appropriate, as long as it doesn't become a standard for all time and all place, which is very unhealthy.
It gets to, and we're running out of time here, the difficulty often of establishing, particularly when you look across time, of what is a right and what is a wrong reading.
Because
that can look and feel in very different ways. You know, I mean, as an historian, you look at this text and you say, okay, this is a piece of ancient Near Eastern erotic literature.
Right.
And it sort of fits that genre description. And Gregory does something with it to try to spiritualize it. And there's all kinds of, he finds the Godhead here and there. I mean, just, it's a fascinating ride. And in a way, it's brilliant art to watch him do his thing. The question I raise, which I raise back again, and I also have to leave you with that because we've run out of time, is that when you do that, do you do, in a sense, violence to the text, or specifically violence to the human beings and the figures they inhabit and the act of human sexuality. I think there is something lost, in all candor, in the brilliance of Gregory.
And I think what I find bothersome is not just that he does it, is that he seems to do it in some kind of unconscious way. That it's this, I mean, maybe there is some way in which he is understanding this, but this sublimation is happening in some kind of, looks to me like a reactive, instinctive, you know, kind of panicky way, versus to say, to acknowledge what it is and say, okay, but now we can read it like this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he talks about the obvious literal sin. You know?
Right.
It's just so clear that this can't be beneficial.
Right.
So it has to be this.
Right.
There's no way it's really about that.
Right. And we're actually past time. I feel like we're just kind of getting started. I'm happy to continue conversations after, but thank you all for this quick 45 minutes with Gregory and Scandalous Scripture.